Christ, there had to be another way. Out of that, a new holiday was born. A Festivus for the rest of us.
This new holiday of yours is scratching me right where I itch.
Let's do it then.
All right.
Festivus is back!
Ladies and gentlemen!
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Banal of America Audio Holiday Special featuring Stanton Friedman.
Happy Holidays!
With your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. And really, that goes without saying, especially on tonight's program. For the first time ever, we're doing this one live. Hopefully it runs smoothly. It is the 12th annual BOA Audio Holiday Special featuring Stanton Friedman. He is a legend. He's my hero in a lot of ways. I've said it a million times on this show. If I wasn't doing this show, it wouldn't be because of him, because he gave me my very first interview. So I was like, that started all this. So I hold him very, very dear to my heart, and that's why we have the holiday special, and it's unbelievable. It's been 12 years we've been doing this, Dan. It's just absolutely crazy, and it's one of the signature programs in this whole, in the series here. So thank you so much for being a part of it. Thank you for coming back. Welcome back to the show. Happy holidays. I'm excited. It's the holiday season finally once again. Welcome back, buddy.
Well, glad to be here again. I'm glad to be still alive. What the heck?
Hey, man. You got to be there for the 70th at least, and hopefully the 75th, and more of those big anniversaries. But we'll talk about that in a little bit, because it should be exciting. I might try and make it out this year for the 70th, so we'll see. I'm talking about Roswell, of course, but
yes.
I figure they know that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, tell me first, you got a new book that came out. We want to tell people about this, because you still got four or five shopping days till Christmas. And I'm sure it's in the Barnes & Nobles and the whatever bookstore.
Amazon and all that. Yeah, I think they're still Amazon.
So tell us about the new book and give me a little thumbnail on it.
The book is Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers by Kathleen Marden and myself. This is our third book together. And it's different from the other ones. There are a lot of UFO books. Every time I turn around, I see a new one. I haven't read them all, but I'll try to get to most of them. But we decided that there was really a need for stepping back a little bit and saying, so how come sensible, thinking, smart people have said some dumb things about flying saucers? I'm thinking of the nasty, noisy negativists, as I call them, people like Phil Klass or Ed Condon or Donald Menzel. And, these aren't idiots. And so what we've done is we've gone to the archives. Their papers are at the American Philosophical Society Library, for example, and I've been to 20 archives altogether. Kathy's been to a number of them. To try to sort out what's going on here. And we finally realized that there are connections between these people that weren't obvious at all, and that the three have in common that the irrationality, the clear, obvious, not derived from facts, statements that these guys have made over the years. I mean, I'm a nuclear physicist. Okay, Ed Condon was a very smart physicist. He was invited to become part of the National Academy of Sciences in his 40s. He was elected president of the American Physical Society one year and president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. This isn't a dink. Very smart guy.
Yeah.
Published a lot of papers, all that sort of thing. So how could he say things like, it seems clear that there won't be any visitors to Earth by aliens for the next 10,000 years? You know, I wouldn't take bets on 50 years from now. Why? How could he possibly say 10,000? Donald Menzel has been attacking UFO reality, tried to convince the Air Force they ought to let him identify all their cases because they all had prosaic explanations. They didn't buy it, fortunately. Phil Klass and I have tangled a great deal for the last 20 years of his life, or more than that, I guess. And he's a good writer for Aviation Week in Space Technology. How could he say all the dumb things that he said about flying saucers? I mean, you know that he paid me $1,000 proving him wrong about something that he had no business even suggesting was true. He'd never been to the Eisenhower Library, and he challenged me that a certain document related to MJ-12 was done on the wrong kind of type. It was a large pica type, but the National Security Council, which supposedly was responsible for this, only used elite type, and he had 10 samples to prove that, and he'd give me $100 each for every genuine memo, and he had a number of conditions done in the same size and style type. Now, the reason this is outrageous is he had never been, I checked twice, to the Eisenhower Library. They got 250,000 pages of National Security Council material. How could anybody dare to make such a challenge?
He probably didn't think he'd bother. He probably didn't think he'd bother, and then he could, then he could crow about it.
Well, I suppose.
Joke was on him.
He paid me, and he got madder than heck when I published a copy of his check in a book.
Nice.
Threatened to sue me, and I had taken off, blacked out the banking information,
Oh, that's good, yeah.
I was a good guy, but I told him, Phil, you sent me a check. I Xeroxed it. I took the check to the bank. They cashed it. I could do whatever I please with the Xerox. And then he shut up. But these guys were all... Menzel was not just an astronomer, he was chairman of the astronomy department, also a member of the National Academy of Sciences. Well, I found out the answer about a clear-cut, unambiguous answer about Menzel. I was trying to find out more about this ostensible MJ-12 group, which didn't make any sense because Menzel's name was on it. As a member, how could a guy who'd written 3 anti-UFO books, the king of the debunkers in the 50s and 60s...
Right. This is how you discovered how you discovered that he had all these clearances. Now, let me sort of jump ahead, because we've covered these, we've done these a million times. People love these stories, but, they'll give me grief, because I don't... because I like hearing them. So what did you come to some sort of conclusion that these people, that maybe these most outspoken people, are you saying, I don't want to put words in your mouth because I haven't read the book yet, but are you sort of like postulating that perhaps they were doing this with less than honorable intentions, let's say?
Yes. Well, it's more than that. That they clearly were doing it for somebody or some movement or whatever you want to call it. There was a purpose here. It wasn't random.
Right.
That there was a movement afoot, in other words.
Mm.
At least with Menzel, we know who he worked for, National Security Agency, among others, CIA also, and stuff. But why was Condon taking this attitude? Klass. Now, I happen to know that Aviation Week in Space Technology, which employed Klass for many years, fired somebody when they found out he had a connection with the CIA. You remember the Church Committee and those hundreds of journalists, supposedly objective seekers of truth, had a straight connection with the CIA. And in many cases, their employers knew about it. which came as a great shock to the American public, of course, because you don't expect the public, the press, to be working
right.
for the CIA.
God knows
I mean,
what's going on now, yeah.
Yeah, and look, it didn't surprise me because in an intelligence project that I did in the early 60s, mind you, looking at Soviet capabilities with regard to building nuclear systems for space, I visited archives that had loads of Soviet information in them, but also reports from people who were traveling and attended meetings and were reporting back to the CIA on what happened at those meetings. These guys weren't employees of the CIA, but they made nice, you know. And so that's your patriotic duty, I suppose, if somebody asks you from the government, hey, you're going to be at this meeting, and we'd sure like to know what's going on, and you're qualified to be there. We're not, so give us a hand. I mean, I can understand that. But these three guys, like I say, with Menzel, it's easy to understand. I didn't like him when I didn't know that he had worked for the NSA for 30 years.
Yeah.
With Klass, he did so much to try to discredit people, and some of it very much behind the scenes.
Right, right.
You know, why would he write a letter to the FBI about Hynek?
Yeah, he's very cloak and dagger, which is in keeping with the idea that he was, you know, doing this at the behest of somebody, that there was something going on there. That yeah.
Why did he write that nasty letter about me to the Canadian government? What a strange thing to do, you know, warning them that I would be moving to the USO and from the USA to Canada, and that I would be saying that there was a cosmic Watergate and all kinds of other stuff. Well, why would he do that? What benefit to him? You know, it sounds like something he's doing for somebody else.
Right.
And so we concluded at least that there were... there was ample evidence of collusion, if you will. We found correspondence to Klass from both Condon and Menzel. And certainly Condon and Menzel were buddies, if you will, fishing buddies, among other things. And so we could understand. Now, I can't prove to you that Condon knew that Menzel worked for the NSA for 30 years.
Right, right,
you know.
Exactly. It's just,
but
yeah,
it's very suggestive of something like that. Or, I hate to suggest this, it sounds too conspirational, but Condon had had plenty of troubles with the government about security in some of his earlier jobs in the 50s and so forth. Maybe they knew something about him that they put the gun to his head and said, Ed, here's what you've got to do now.
Mm.
And if you do, we won't say anything to you about this other thing. Well, I mean, I say that only because we found in the FBI files on Klass that on two occasions he had leaked classified material and they wanted to pursue him for that.
Oh, boy.
That's a violation of law.
I've heard.
And they couldn't get the stuff declassified so they could pursue him. So... You know, he got away with it. And so the whole point is to explore the relationship amongst the three people.
Yeah, yeah.
And nobody else has really looked at this question of what's going on with the nasty, noisy negativists, as I call them politely. You know?
Right, right. Yeah. Well, because it seems very strange in the... It definitely seems like they were working at the behest of somebody. I mean, everyone's always kind of said that, so it's like your book actually puts it all together and tries to get to the bottom of it. Is there any? Do you think there's any? I mean, so much time has passed, and you know, we talk about the Roswell thing. Do you think there's any way we'll ever get sort of any more information, or we already sort of plumbed the depths of all the files and stuff we could get on these guys?
Well, I think there may still. I mean, look, Roswell happened 70 years ago. Coming up. So there can't be too many guys alive who were part and parcel of that, but I'm hoping that maybe somebody will find letters from a father or grandfather.
Right.
You know, will find some piece of paper somewhere that people do find things like that. Hey, look what I found.
Right, know? Right. The Roswell papers sort of pushing that sort of idea, right? That's what I heard recently.
Well, yeah. And... you know, I'm not, I don't know whether that's going to happen or not. As you know, I have staunchly said that governments can keep secrets. And I am not saying everything should be declassified. I think there are some serious national security issues here. The obvious one being, if we've learned something about the technology of these alien visitor craft, why should we put it out on the table if the Russians and Chinese don't put out what they've learned? You know,
right.
That doesn't make sense to me. I was a good soldier for 14 years working under security, and I take it very seriously. That doesn't mean I don't think the public is entitled to know that the planet's being visited. After all, I've been saying that in public lecture since 1967. But I'm not saying everything should be released. And I think there are some people in the disclosure movement who are saying that, and I just don't buy it.
Right, right. That's just, well, as I was saying to you when we set up the interview, I feel like this disclosure movement's hit the wall because they put all their eggs in the Hillary Clinton basket, and they have no
yes.
no plan whatsoever for the Donald Trump administration. And
no plan B.
Yeah.
And, you know, people ask me about Trump and security and stuff, and I will first off admit I'm not a fan of his. Second of all, as somebody who had a clearance for 14 years, I have difficulty believing that he'd be willing to shut up for anybody.
Yes.
You know, I wouldn't trust him with classified information because I don't trust him to do anything other than what he feels like doing.
Well, here's the thing. On a human level, it's also, I was saying this to somebody the other day, it's if they tell him about anything like related to UFOs or aliens or anything like that revelatory, you know he's not going to be able to help himself and he'll tell his kids because that family seems so tight-knit, you know? So then all of a sudden it's getting, you know, and the people who tell him this information must know that, too. You know? Like,
well,
I'm sure Obama didn't tell
right.
his kids whatever he got told
well,
about aliens.
You can't tell your friends without telling your enemies, or relatives without telling your enemies. And so I have no idea what's going to happen. And I wish to strenuously express the view that presidents don't have access to everything.
Right, right.
Because they meet with the press all the time, and they might inadvertently release something that seems innocent, but that gives a spy information that he otherwise wouldn't have gotten. You know, and tells what corner of the desk to look under.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I never thought of it that way, but you're right. It's like, It's that explains in a lot of ways the need to know thing, and I never really considered where it's like just knowing you might by accident tell people or something. So, yeah.
Well, that's right. That's why I still get people telling me that, well, if somebody's got a top secret clearance, he gets access to all top secret information. No way. That's not the way it works. That's why that need to know thing is there. The proof that you can't do that is the requirement for a need to know before getting access to highly classified
yeah.
material. So, you know, these are interesting times.
That's for sure.
About such things, especially with this transition coming up. And Lord knows what it's going to be like in the next 6 months.
Yeah. Have you been following this story about the fake news thing?
Well, I've heard bits and pieces about it, and it does concern me because if the media isn't doing its job and getting facts in hand before putting mouth in gear, we're all in trouble.
Well, let me put it this way. I agree with you on that, believe me. But it's I feel like there's a lot of layers going on here. I'm worried that the paranormal is going to be and especially UFOs and other you know, high-profile topics are going to be, like, swept into this
yes.
this net. And I want to read you something. This is what a skeptic wrote. An article asked for insight from a skeptic. I'm not going to name this person because it's not worth my time. But they say the origins of fake news go back to the 1950s when UFO newsletters from organizations like APRO reported on alien abductions and government cover-ups, which led to Long John Nebel, who then began the fake news phenomenon. Which
what?
To me, Thank you. Is that not the most asinine, stupid,
yes,
historically incorrect thing you could possibly say? It's just,
yes,
mind-boggling. That's from a skeptic. I'll email you this person's name. But
is that person a journalist?
They are billed as a science writer and editor who reports on fake news, pseudoscience, and conspiracy theories.
Oh, my
theories.
Goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was
yeah,
a
that's pretty absurd.
Yeah,
it's historically gross, you know.
That's,
and
yeah.
I was a member of APRO, and I can say that as an insider, if you will. They're the ones who asked me to talk to Marjorie Fish, for example, about the Betty Hill Star map and stuff like that. So I was on their list of good guys, if you will. And it's nonsense.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of nonsense around.
Right, exactly. Just like, you know, we don't need people spreading that kind of crap because it's so incorrect that we're like, it's like, yeah, blame all this on UFOs. That's insane.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, it's tragic, but it's funny.
Yeah, it's sad that somebody, it's not only sad that somebody's so wrong about it, but that someone else, you know, like I said, like you were saying, get your facts in hand. It's like, that. This counts as journalism these days? This is what this person got from a so-called expert? Are you kidding me? Well, the
must
new book.
Be kidding you.
Yeah, what's that?
I say they must be kidding you.
Yeah, I hope so. The new book, once again, for folks, is Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, and I'm looking at it right now on Amazon. You can add it to your cart right this very minute. So do that, and if you want to do some listener questions, we got a slew of them. So
sure, why not?
All right, it's that time of year. You know how it is.
Yeah.
All right, let me see here. Get this thing up. All right. Tim, not me, but some other Tim. Tim in Trenton, New Jersey. He wants to know your opinion on these two books, UFOs, Yes, by David Saunders, and Aliens in the Skies by John G. Fuller. He says they both take well-deserved swipes at Condon and the Colorado Committee, and he notes that Saunders was fired from the committee and that you own the final chapter of Aliens in the Skies. So you must have really impressed him there. But what are your thoughts on those books?
Well, yeah, I like Saunders' books. And he didn't give a satisfactory answer to the question, why the heck did Condon take the approach he did? But he certainly established that it was irrational. He was not investigating UFO sightings and so forth and so on. So I've met I presume he's not with us anymore. I don't know that for a fact. But when I tried to find him, I think I discovered that he was deceased. And if John is, if he's still alive and listening, tell him to correct me. The Aliens in the Skies, the one thing that disappointed me there was that he left out all the references that were in my papers. In my congressional testimony, he does present testimony, but without the references. And part of my efforts are to try to encourage people, justify the claims that you make. Give us facts. Give us a reference. It's my argument with Carl Sagan. You know, we're classmates. I respect his scientific background, et cetera. But he made claims that had no basis in fact, and he made no attempt. He said there are interesting sightings that aren't reliable, and there are reliable sightings that aren't interesting, and I don't disagree with those two things. And then he says there are no interesting and reliable sightings. Based on what? The largest study ever done showed exactly the opposite. You know, the more reliable the sighting, the more likely it was unexplainable. That's consistent with sightings being good, not bad. So I like to see references. And so that was my one concern about John in that book, that he didn't include references. But it was a pretty good book. I don't think I don't know how well it sold. But he included a lot of good stuff in it.
All right. Lobo Mateus, who I believe interviewed you on his show Project Archivist earlier this year, he wants to know if you can expound upon your earlier research and development of nuclear power being used in everyday items like automobiles and planes.
Well, okay, those are two separate automobiles and planes aren't the same thing. I have no reason to think that nuclear power can be used in automobiles. I realize that umpteen years ago, people were saying, you know, we'll have nuclear-powered automobiles. I've never bought it then, and I don't buy it now. Now, airplanes is another matter. I worked at General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department in just outside Cincinnati from 1956 to 1959. It was a big program. I worked on radiation shielding because that's a major problem for nuclear airplanes because you don't want to cook the pilots. Not a good idea, you know. So it was a big program. We spent $100 million in 1958. That one year
Wow.
we spent $100 million. And that was a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
You know, now it's chicken feed. Well, not to me or you. But, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
But we also employed 3,500 people, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. And we did a lot of work on all aspects of the problem, but for political reasons, it was basically canceled when the Eisenhower administration took over. And I predicted that. I left the program late in 1959, and I told people when I left that I'm not sure there's going to be an ANP here in a year or two. It was canceled 16 months later.
Ah, yeah.
Because I saw GE had nothing involved. They owned the rug on the boss's floor.
Yeah,
that's about
that.
It.
Yeah.
It was cost recovery, you know, cost plus program. You get a certain percentage on the amount of money you bill. But it wasn't a trivial program. We did successfully operate jet engines on nuclear power, but it wasn't in an airplane. And, you know, the people say, well, why would you do that in the first place? Well, the reason is pretty obvious when you think about it. If you can fly for thousands of hours without refueling, that would be kind of neat, wouldn't it?
You know. Exactly.
And the analog, incidentally, is the nuclear Navy. Rickover was quite successful. Hyman Rickover ran the Naval Nuclear Reactors Program. And they developed submarines that could go around the world underwater without refueling. Now, people don't realize it, I suppose, but in World War II, the German U-boats, you know, they were such a threat, they sank a lot of ships.
Oh, yeah.
They could only stay under for about a day because they needed air for the diesel engines. But when you have a nuclear-powered submarine, nobody knows where it is. So mutually assured destruction, you know.
Yeah.
If the Russian were to attack us, they know that the submarines, which are wherever they are, but we don't know where they are, could retaliate with missiles, Polaris and so forth missiles that had nuclear warheads on them. So maybe it's not a good idea for us to attack them. And also, the other parallel with the Navy is that we have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers that can operate for 18 years without refueling. Now, that gives a sea captain of one of these things incredible versatility. You know, the Navy is normally restricted by, if it's not nuclear, you got to get fuel for the damn ships. You know?
Do the other countries that, like China and Russia, have that capability?
I think so, but I'm not sure. But
yeah.
I think so. I haven't been on board one. I haven't been on ours either, but I know we have them. But what I'm saying is certainly people were impressed with the fact that the nuclear Navy was so successful. And so maybe we can use nuclear-powered airplanes. As a matter of fact, there was a program to develop nuclear-powered ramjets, Ling Temco Vought. Late 50s, early 60s. Did some ground testing, but this would be basically a rocket engine, a ramjet, that you'd carry aloft with a B-52, and you'd release it, and it could stay up there for a very long time, and when you needed a bomb dropped on somebody, you could do it.
Yeah.
You know, kind of neat, I guess, but they didn't get as far as we did. And our program was canceled. And so There's one other area where nuclear energy is certainly important here, and that is the radioisotope thermoelectric generators. You know, we sent a craft past Pluto. Took 9.5 years to get there.
Right, right. This is the nuclear-powered satellite or whatever it is, right?
Well, it was a satellite, and nuclear-powered isn't quite... Well, I'll use it. I'll say it's okay to use it.
You'll give me partial credit. You'll give me partial credit. That's all I need.
Yes. Oh, yes. Radioisotopes. Well, the thing is that most of our deep space probes... I mean, stop to think about it. Pluto is so far away, the amount of energy you get from the sun is pretty small.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So an RTG, radioisotope thermoelectric generator, has been used to power loads of deep space probes, including the ones that left the solar system. They're small. I've worked with them when I was at TRW Systems. They're pretty neat. So that's, and they use plutonium, but it's not the isotope that can be used in bombs, fortunately. So nobody's going to go try to grab plutonium-238, because other than powering radioisotope thermoelectric generators, it's not of much use, you know?
Yeah.
And you don't go around saying, hey, you want to buy some U-238 or Bu-238?
I hope not.
No, not a good idea.
All right.
So it's illegal, as a matter of fact. Radioisotope material is not something that can just be handled and sold and stored.
I wouldn't even know where to get it.
Like anybody. Yeah. It ain't easy, man.
Oh, man. David Gerzinski asks, he wants to know your opinion on Project Orion and the early cruise missile idea known as the Flying Crowbar.
Well, Project Orion, and there is going to be an Orion rocket that's going to be sent up within the next year or two from NASA, but a different program. The early idea was to use nuclear energy for deep space propulsion to go to the stars. We'd carry along a bunch of small H-bombs and put it up, and you'd drop one out the back end, and you'd have a pusher plate. And you'd explode it, and some of the energy would push on the plate and push the rocket forward. Mm. And you've got a whole slew of these. There's so much energy. People don't have a good handle, I think, on why one would go nuclear. Well, let me give you three numbers. The power of three different bombs. A big bomb in World War II. It was a 10-ton blockbuster. Took a big B-29 to carry it, make a big hole in the ground, and release the energy of 10 tons of dynamite. Wow.
Yeah.
And we dropped a lot of them. You know, people may not be aware, but during World War II, there were bombing raids where we had 500 airplanes flying at once over Europe and dropping bombs. 500 planes.
Wow.
So, the biggest bombs were released the energy of 10 tons of dynamite. Okay, our first atomic bomb, which was set off in Trinity Site in New Mexico in, June of 1945, that released the energy of 16,000 tons of dynamite. You can see why we spent all that dough on the Manhattan Project. You go from 10 tons in one bomb of dynamite equivalent energy, unit, to 16,000 tons. But we kept at it, and our first H-bomb, hydrogen bomb, which was exploded in 1952. We even have a name for it, Mike. Don't ask me where the Mike comes from. released the energy of 10 million tons of TNT.
Whew.
So from 10 to 16,000 to 10 million. And the Russians lit one up that a few years after that, released the energy of 57 million tons of TNT.
Wow. So
one
if you use that for propulsion,
weapon.
You'd be doing all right in space is what you're saying.
Well, what I'm saying is two things. One, every advanced civilization is going to ask, how does that star of ours produce all that energy? And the answer, which we found out in 1938, was nuclear fusion. Everybody's going to look for that. What is it? I'm not saying it's the ultimate, but I'm saying all the stars in the universe produce their energy by nuclear fusion. Second thing is, it's perfectly obvious that if you want to go to the stars, there's your best energy source.
Yeah.
You can exhaust particles that have 10 million times as much energy as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket.
Right, exactly. It's almost natural. It's coming right. The universe is showing us the way to do it. It's the sun.
Well, yeah. I'm glad you caught that, because some people say, well, how would they know? Well, everybody is going to look for, where does the star get its energy from? You know that in the 20s we thought it was from burning chemicals?
They thought the energy from the sun was from burning chemicals?
Well, big mass of burning gas, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And it wasn't look, we didn't even discover the neutron until 1932. You know, they've been there all the billions of years the Earth's been around.
That's true. Yeah, there you go. So when someone tells you that the aliens can't be here, tell them, what about the neutrons? You know, that's what I say about the people, you know, the people that when they discovered the New World. It's like America and all that was here all along in ancient Greek times and things. So, you know, how do we know
the
aliens?
I thought it didn't show up until Columbus came along.
Exactly. what about the flying crowbar? What is this thing? Do you know anything about that?
I don't know if he's talking about the linked tentacle.
This is a cruise missile idea known as the flying.
Well, it looks like a missile. It's a nuclear ramjet. The air comes in one end, gets heated in the reactor, and goes out the other end. Now, you have to understand something here. We're not, when we say kicked out the back end, on the nuclear rockets that I worked on, the fission rockets, the exhaust temperature of the hydrogen comes in very cold, liquid hydrogen, close to absolute zero. And you kick it out the back end after it's been heated in the reactor, and it is going, it's at over 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit. You know, with jet engines, we're only talking around 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
So the fission rocket, in other words, and there's no oxidizer. Hydrogen's the lightest. It's kind of nice, isn't it? You're going to use something that's the lightest and most abundant element in the universe, hydrogen. Wherever you go, you're going to find hydrogen. Uranium, that's another story.
Yeah.
It's one of the heavier elements, you know. One of the heaviest elements.
One of the listeners says that maybe he's the flying crowbar. Maybe he means something called the Pluto weapon. Have you heard of it?
Well, that's what I was talking about. Okay. The ramjet. The name was Pluto.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Not the dog, but I'm sorry.
There you go. No. They got things coming at me left and right here. Speaking of which, that very person, he's listening now, and his question is up now. He's Steve Ray, good friend, good guy. And he says, since nuclear physicists must understand every element of the periodic table, please ask Dr. Friedman, which that'll allow us to do the annual explainer there, which one is the best element, or at least your favorite? What's your favorite element on the periodic table and why?
Oh, my favorite element on the periodic table. What a strange question. You know, I like uranium just because it has so many uses. Like for the aircraft carriers and ramjets and all kinds of things. I like plutonium because it's neat. You know, we spent a lot of effort to make it and stuff.
Yeah.
And because it doesn't occur naturally in nature. Uranium does, but there isn't enough of it around, really. So, I'll have to think about that some more. Favorite element. Which element do I love the most?
Well, I figured the obvious answer is gold.
Well, I don't have much of that.
And then the other joke that I thought of when I read Steve's question was no love for element 115 from Bob Lazar. That, oh my God, that's a lucky guess in a way, because like I could say I an alien came down and gave me element like 123, and eventually they'll get to 123, I assume. So,
Well, maybe. Yeah, 115 was much more likely than 123.
It's only eight away. You never know. It was a long
That's a good
time.
Way to put it.
Like you said, we just started figuring this stuff out like 100 years ago, so who knows? Who knows how many they'll wind up
being. Yeah, I'm not a lover of Element 115.
I didn't think
and
so.
Anybody who thinks you can use it for a propulsion system really has to answer a couple questions. Where do you get it? The discovery was made on the basis of four atoms of 115 that were produced in a huge accelerator operating for weeks. Four atoms. Now, if you had four followed by 24 zeros atoms, then maybe you could do something useful with it. The second problem is the half-life is less than 2 minutes. So how do you do something useful with something that's there's only half of it left after 2 minutes? Another 2 minutes, another half's gone, and so forth.
Exactly,
So it isn't very useful. There are radioactive isotopes that have half-lives of a million years, or 10,000 years. But you can do something useful with those.
Right.
But 2 minutes hardly qualifies.
Exactly, yeah. Ron Ostrander wants to know a lot of interesting questions this year about sort of obscure areas, obscure topics. This one's another one. He says, Ron Ostrander says, good health and best wishes to Mr. Friedman at the holidays. He wants to know if you're familiar with the sketchy 1970s documentary Overlords of the UFO, which features an appearance by you via film stock footage taken at some news conference or similar event. And he wants to know what your impression of that film is.
I remember, I can't give you specifics because it was a long time ago, but I remember when it came out and I was disgusted with it, and I don't know how I wound up in that. They used some footage. Certainly I didn't intentionally get involved with that piece of junk. It was pretty sad.
I bet you it's on YouTube by now, but yeah, I've never seen
it. Well, probably everything else.
Yeah, exactly.
But no, I'm not a fan of Overlords of the UFO.
What, just for my edification, what was it? Like a bad, was it like sort of were they trying to scare people that like the UFOs were coming to get us or something like that? Was there like a...
Well, it was as bad as that. Yeah, the whole tone was wrong about what they could do and, like they're here to destroy us and all kinds of stuff like that. And with nothing to back it up. My basic rule, have facts in hand before putting mouth in gear.
Exactly.
And I didn't say anything that was wrong, but the movie certainly did.
Paula Summit wants to know, or Paula Samet, I think, I don't know, one or the other. She wants to know your opinion on the work of Jacques Vallée, which is less nuts and bolts and more extra-dimensional. We've talked a little bit about this in the past, but...
Well, I talked to Jacques not long ago at all.
Oh, nice.
We are on good terms, and when I get out to San Francisco, I'll go see him. And, that's one of my favorite cities anyway. I lived for 3 years, 30 miles away. But, no, I think Jacques did an awful lot of pioneering work in ufology, collecting data, and I think he's got a new book out, but I haven't seen it.
I'm not sure if it's very, very new, but I know he sort of put a new one out in the last few years and kind of talking a lot about the historical record in UFOs.
Well, yeah, that one, no, but there's one after that. Jacques, we've seen each other. We both testified at that strange conference in Saudi Arabia, for example.
Oh, nice.
We've been friendly and so forth. But more important, Jacques is a real scientist. And the difference between us is my background is in advanced technology. I worked on nuclear airplanes, fission rockets. I was involved in a study of fusion rockets way back, God forbid I should mention, it was 1962 that I worked on that. He doesn't have that background in advanced technology. On the other hand, in terms of collecting reports from hither, thither, and yon, and doing a good job of it, and having the courage to deal with the astronomers. I mean, his degree was in astronomy, and he worked with J. Allen Hynek. And I had a problem with Alan. I could never get him to look at the literature about interstellar travel technology. Because most astronomers think that you can't get here from there, so what's the point in looking, you know?
Right, right.
But Jacques is solid. He's dependable, and I've never caught him in saying something that was obviously untrue, but he was trying to get away with it. And there are a lot of people, I can't say that. I didn't catch
yeah.
them in that.
Especially the world of UFOs. Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Now, you don't have to tell me what you talk about, but let me pose this question. When you see him nowadays or talk to him, do you guys actually talk about the UFO phenomenon still, or is it like, how's the grandkids, you know, like what's
it like?
You mean
Jacques
Vallée? Yeah, yeah. Like, cause I'm just like imagining you guys as sort of these wizened, no offense, old legends. You know, it's like, you know, Bob Dylan and Mick Jagger sitting around talking about writing songs together. Like, do you guys still talk about UFOs together, or
yes.
you just kind of? Oh, that must be amazing.
Well, we do talk about UFOs, and we talk about the bigger picture, and you know what's going to happen. And and there's another thing that's happened that who would have predicted. That we have so much more evidence now of there being other planets out there. It wasn't too many years ago that there were people denying there were other solar systems.
Oh, yeah.
The only one, you know. So thanks to the Kepler and other astronomical devices. But, you know, I'll give you an incredible statistic. From the data I've been able to find, there's between 1 and 1.6 planets per star. Some might have 9.
Right.
Like, well, our solar system has 8 or 9 or 10 or whatever number you want to pick. But we didn't know that. And so I find it so ludicrous when some of the SETI people, you know, I have to say SETI stands for Silly Effort to Investigate, you know, when they act like, there's no way you can get here. And Frank Drake once said there could be as many as 8 or 10,000 places in the galaxy.
Right.
And now a better number would be 8 or 10 billion solar systems. I'm not saying every planet out there has life on it, just like not every atom is fissionable, but there are enough that are to make it interesting to use it.
Yeah, exactly.
So our whole attitude about there being other life, we talk about probability. How can you assess probability when you don't have any data? I mean, if I toss a coin, it's either going to come up heads or tails, you know, 1 and 2. But there are many other things. What's the probability of our finding or them having found us? We don't know. You know, how many ships you're sending out per year? Maybe you get lucky.
Right.
What was the probability of Columbus finding a new continent? It wasn't a new continent. We just didn't know about it.
Well, it's funny. I don't know if you noticed. It's like it seems like they, and by they, I guess I mean mainstream science. You know, some people will take issue with that, but whatever. They're almost twisting themselves into knots now as they get more information like this, because I saw an article recently, and I'm sure I'm going to butcher the idea, but butcher the details of it, but the idea is generally that, like, some statistician put together, like, an equation where it was like, it's almost certain that aliens exist, but they went extinct before they could ever get to us, because, you know.
Yeah,
like,
I've seen that.
Yeah, and it's like,
what's
oh,
the
geez.
Basis for that?
Yeah.
Well, if you throw darts at a dartboard with numbers on it, that's why you
right,
come
exactly.
up with the
yeah.
authority, you know.
Like I said, they're twisting themselves into knots, because they're like, all right,
well,
how can we...
They seem to think that if aliens were out there, they would land on a White House lawn and say, hi, Earthlings, what can we do for you?
Yeah.
They can't think of any other reason to come here. One of my books, I think I got 15 or so reasons to come here. You know? They do a weekly radio show or an annual one. Idiocy in the Boondocks. Here we are at Earth again this year, folks.
Well, they'd love it this year. This must be the highest rated year they've ever had, Idiot in the Boondocks.
Well, yeah, I think you're right. But, you know, why did Columbus and all those other guys head west? Well, some of them went to convert the heathen. Some of them went to steal the gold. That ought to be my favorite element.
Right.
You know, some of them went to bring back vegetables, tobacco, tomatoes, potatoes. We didn't have those before in Europe.
Yeah.
And to get slaves, to steal land, for a penal colony. I mean, look how the first Englishmen to wind up in Australia were convicts.
Right.
They're proud of it. So maybe Earth, the whole planet, is a penal colony. They dumped all the bad boys and girls here. That's why we're so nasty to each other. They call it selective breeding. You know, we got the worst ones, don't we?
Well, I'm sure they realize this, but it's like anyone who says, why don't they land on the White House lawn, you better hope they don't, because otherwise, you know, we'll end up like the Native Americans. We'll be the Native Earthlings. We'll be the people that got wiped out by the advanced culture. So.
Well, yeah, I think, frankly, I think the Galactic Federation probably has rules that we certainly have not accepted about not interfering with what's going on.
Hmm.
Rules of behavior. Isn't that why we have congresses and senates?
Exactly, yeah.
So forth. We civilized people make rules that they abide by that respect other people's rights. No, we don't see much of that happening here, do we?
Well, yeah, yeah. And it stands to reason that, like, if there's intelligence is smart enough to travel between the planets, that they then it's not the Wild West out there. It's like that's
right.
Kind of funny in a way, because it's like the human perspective on space still is that it's like the Wild West, but it's
yes,
but
yes.
It's but if you
makes
can get
no
out
sense.
There, yeah, yeah, if you can get out there, you know, that's probably why there's this tension maybe between the two, you know, between whatever the UFO is and whatever we are, because it's like we're not mature enough to understand what we're doing out there.
Hey, look, when you spend $1 trillion a year, as we do on this planet, for things military, that tells you a great deal about us, because after all, it's not as if there aren't people starving to death every single day.
Yeah.
It tells you where our priorities are, and I can't imagine any real advanced civilization accepting those as, well, that's the right priority, see who you can kill the most, or, you know, have the most bombs or stuff. You know, look, we've exploded 2,000 nuclear weapons on this planet. Some people say, what do you mean 2,000? We haven't. We have. Look it up. That tells you a lot about us. Fortunately, only two on people. But
well, it's funny, in a sense, it's like, not to get too philosophical, but it's like, if we could get into space as a species, I think that would end a lot of the conflicts, in a sense, because literally the sky is the limit. You wouldn't have to be fighting over land and territory and resources
yeah.
anymore. It's like, you know, that's what the collective human race should be working towards, is to expand beyond the Earth so we don't fight.
Oh, come on, I want to settle Mars so I can steal the gold from there.
There you go. All right, we'll zip along to the next one, because we're
okay.
we could get into that for a while. Sean, and this one kind of jumps from that. Sean Kotz wants to know if you think it would take an undeniable event/crisis event like landing on the White House lawn to persuade people that the phenomenon is worth mainstream scientific attention, or is it possible that it will eventually get funded scientific studies due to a general cultural change? I've kind of advocated that as my generation, and God forbid the millennials, grow older, maybe there'll be more of a move towards it, but who knows? So that's kind of the question for you.
Well, I think that there are a lot of problems with recognition of alien visitations. One of them would be giving up power. There's nobody who speaks for the planet. How many people think of themselves as Earthlings as opposed to Greeks or French or Chinese or American or Canadian or whatever? We have a national identity instead of a planetary one. And we're not ready. And nobody in power, this is an observation after 82 years of being around this planet, nobody in power wants to give up power, do they?
No way.
You know, I'm going to step aside and let the planetary look over. Ha! That'll be the day.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So that's a major concern.
Okay, so you think, yeah. All right, I'm trying to see if there's anything we missed sort of in that question. But I think, we've always been waiting for that tipping point. So, you know,
yeah.
Who knows? It's like, I still feel like that they'll, maybe the best workaround, if they're really trying, if they really want to advance this any further, would be to sort of find, like, as ridiculous as that whole Face on Mars thing is, it's like, find some old thing somewhere else where you can be like, okay, we know that this is real, but they're not going to come hurt us. Maybe. Who knows? You know what I mean? But,
well, you know, it's kind of like when I was working on the nuclear rocket engine for, I worked for Westinghouse, but Los Alamos and Aerojet were also working on nuclear rocket engines, and we all successfully tested them. The thought was that these would be an upper stage to take us to Mars, and the first nuclear rocket engine upper stage would be launched in 1978 was the plan. But President Nixon canceled the program in the early 70s. Now, I don't know why he canceled the program. Wasn't enough money. Who knows what went on?
Yeah.
Maybe the Martians said, stay the heck off our planet.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, who knows? We don't know. But what I'm saying was, that was what its primary use would be. Would be an upper stage to set up a colony on Mars. Triple the payload with as compared to a chemical rocket.
Right.
Makes it very attractive.
And, again, like, not to get too philosophical, this sort of thought just crossed my mind as we were talking. It was, you know, this idea that Sean mentions, you know, about a generational, the next generational, maybe sort of treat this with respect or something. It's like, listen,
yeah.
Folks, Stan and I have been doing this show for 12 years, and I had that attitude. I got, even when I read Sean's question, I was still bullish about it. But the more I thought about it as I was listening to you, you know, it's like, I don't know, man. My generation, we didn't do anything either. It's like, you know,
well,
maybe the
yeah.
next generation will, but I tell the story all the time, and I like Steve Bassett. I think that some of the disclosure stuff went off the tracks this year because of the election, but I tell this story because it's just a description of sort of the hopefulness of this field and the reality of it. When I first, the conference I first met you at the X conference in D.C. in 2004, I called to get the tickets. I talked to Steve. I'd never met him or anything like that. And he was like, oh, you're only, well, what was that, 2004? So I must have been 25. He said, oh, you're only 25? You're going to be flying to the moon. You're going to be going to Mars in like the next 10 years. It's going to be amazing. Folks, I ain't been to the moon, and I ain't been to Mars, and I'm going to be 40 in a couple years, and I ain't going to moon or to Mars. So the idea that, you know, it's this thing, this whole idea of us getting out there or really, really sort of like doing that is moving so slowly that, you know, maybe the next.
Well, I don't think the aliens want us out there. Would you want such a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare out there? Invading your territory? I don't think so.
Yeah. If anything, they'll let us send some 3D printers out there and build a little city and give us, you know,
Till
we're ready to move in. Steve Grohn, he asked about the so-called disclosure movement, if it'll lead to anything. I think we pretty much covered that one just now, so we can we'll skip that.
You're putting me in a hell of a position here, but I have no choice. You're not going to kill Santa Claus because he doesn't exist. Really, Brian? He doesn't exist. That's right. He's not real. Oh, interesting. Interesting theory, Brian. Who else isn't real? Are you going to tell me that Elmo isn't real? Huh? SpongeBob? Is he not real, Brian? Is SpongeBob not there at the bottom of the ocean giving Squidward the business? And what about Curious George? Huh? Does he not really exist? Is Curious George not really out there making little boats out of newspapers that he should be delivering? Huh? Educate yourself, you fool.
It's the Banal of America Audio Holiday Special featuring Stanton Friedman.
Happy holidays!
It's the one night of the year when we all act a little nicer, we smile a little easier, we share a little more. For a couple of hours out of the whole year, we are the people that we always hoped we would be. Have a Merry Christmas, everybody.